Hello. The weather outside is frightful, but this gigantic pile of records and books and stuff is so delightful. Welcome to Big Mouth's second end-of-year special, where we get some of our regulars to choose their favourite stuff of 2017. I'm Andrew Harrison, and we have two guests today. Anna Fielding is the features editor of Stardust magazine.
Hello.
Hello. So she controls the minds of all the young women you see on the train every Wednesday morning. She's a graduate of the Mixmag School for Gifted Youngsters, and she's been on Big Mouth several times this year in her capacity as Khaleesi of all things Game of Thrones. Hello, Anna. How are you? Welcome back to Big Mouth.
I'm good. I like getting the new title of Khaleesi, and I'm glad you've used it as a title and not a name, because that really annoys me.
It's not canon. Yeah, she's not, you know, it's not Dexy. It's not Echo from the Bunny Men. There isn't somebody called Echo, and her name is not Khaleesi.
Exactly.
Get it right.
Well, there
people.
Is something called Echo.
Yeah, but it was a drum machine. It wasn't a person. Everybody thought that McCulloch was Echo.
Do you reckon that Dr. Rock wasn't a person as well?
It's a machine, Matt. It's a machine.
You of all people should not be denying machines' personality.
My mum just said, she used to say, Dexy, he looks like he needs a wash. Dexy. Anyway, Anna, what's just been your highlights of 2017? Not in terms of like the records and stuff we're going to talk about. What's been the biggest, big fun moment of the year for you?
Oh, gosh. I met Hillary Clinton.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How was she?
Mic drop. Everyone else leave studio.
Sorry.
Just in the pub.
Yeah, just in the pub, randomly in Walthamstow. Yeah. No, it was for work, obviously. I don't move in those kind of circles normally. But I went over to New York, went to the little town she lives in outside in upstate New York, and sat and talked to her for three quarters of an hour. So she was, to use the massive cliche, much warmer in person, although she does have very cold hands.
For cold hands, that's where she lost the election, you see.
Yeah.
Cold hands, cold liberal elite heart there. We're going to touch on this later because obviously it's the big theme of the year. But Stylist has been kind of part of the whole Weinstein world of things, hasn't it? The kind of massive opening up of women in entertainment, basically changing the direction of the way the culture is going. It's just the first time in a long time that entertainment has kind of led the way, the world of pop culture.
I think it is. It's unusual for it to come from Hollywood, I think, because it's so locked down and there's such a power structure. And I think that's why it was interesting, because it had that kind of reach. And if you look at that Me Too thing, it actually spread very, very quickly from the Weinstein thing across nearly every other industry. I think I remember it as a particularly difficult time because we pulled our cover feature and I had to write a new one in about 5 hours.
Oh, right.
But I think it's kind of unprecedented. Mm. And I don't think it's something that I remember speaking to some male friends as it was all breaking, and they were saying, but it's all of you. It's all of you. Why didn't we know? How didn't we know this? Mm. And I think it's been something that people just didn't talk about for whatever reason. It was something I'd obviously talk about with female colleagues and female friends, but it would either be a kind of he's a bit handsy, you know, stay away from that one kind of thing, or it would be like, oh, Jesus Christ, what's he like? Sort of bonding and eye-rolling in the pub. But I think it's the first time that everyone's managed to get collectively angry and on such a scale that you just like, actually, no, this isn't normal. This isn't right or a way to go about life.
Yeah. Do you think there's hasty script revisions going on now in various projects in the pipeline?
I think we've seen that already, haven't we? I mean, look at some of the revelations that have come out that have caused whole films to be dropped on Louis C.K. That's happened to him. They're writing the last season of House of Cards without Kevin Spacey. There's already been a lot of kind of hasty redrawing around things, so we shall see.
Also with us, we have the most interesting thing to come out of Ballymena since Liam Neeson and the Boris Bus. Eamon Ford writes about music and the music business for The Guardian, Q, The Big Issue, and anybody else who'll have him. Hello, Eamon. How are you? It's another year where you failed to interview Bono. Are you going to keep trying?
I am going to keep trying because my love for him knows no end.
Do you think that sitting in his front garden and serenading him through the window, or marinating him through the window the other day, is going to help you get close to Bono?
I will try whatever I can, because my great love for all their music and everything he represents, he will see that. And he will understand that he needs to speak to me.
I want you to choose your favourite thing this year from the following list. Niall Horan calling his album Flicker and then using a typeface that made it look like fucker? Was it the Cadbury's Flake advert by Jonathan Glazer from the 90s, which had Satan leading a sex cult that Cadbury's had to bury because it was too sex pesty? Mm-hmm. Was it Liam Gallagher endorsing Brain Force Plus tablets from Prison Planet? Or was it your idea of starting a They Might Be Giants tribute band called They Might Be Giants?
Well, of course, obviously. It was my idea.
These are all things that Eamon is. You can find on Eamon's heavily curated Twitter feed, where he finds the most amusing things in the world and broadcasts them.
Yes, I do.
To your public.
My public, to one person, and go, please stop putting stuff on the internet. Please take your phone away.
Also, you heard him a minute ago, interjecting, Matt Hall, our producer. How are you, Matt?
I'm throaty.
Dirty. You could say I'm sounding sexy on the radio.
You could, but yeah. Heavily, I'll just settle for throaty.
Heavily,
I'm undecongested.
You should seize the voiceover work while you can. Yeah. What was your personal highlight of 2017 then?
Generally, it was a better year than expected.
A better year than expected. Well, of course, the launch of Romaniacs, our sister podcast.
Made it fantastic. Yeah, yes. Well, I think that, you know what? It's actually people doing things to kind of fight back and saying, no, we will not let this lie. And I would hesitate to tie in something like Romaniacs with kind of Me Too. But, you know, it's interesting. People are just going, we can do something. We have the ability to do something, whether it's contact people and kind of get in touch and put our ideas in front of people. And, you know, and we've just seen last week the Roy Moore getting his posterior handed to him in the previously not very blue state of Alabama. So it's kind of like, you know.
With the fantastic Daily News headline. The headline, because he went to vote on a horse. He went on a horse to vote. And the headline on the New York Daily News was, screw you and the horse you rode in on.
Amazing.
So that's kind of, yeah. Anyway, we'll be here.
Do you think it was like Studio 54 or something? He was Bianca Jagger.
Yeah, Studio 5'4".
A racist Bianca Jagger.
We'll be hearing about more of Matt's favourites later in the show, but let's heal the wounds caused by Theresa May's cavalier treatment of the Northern Irish border issue by starting with Eamon Ford.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
Is this all it was going to say?
Yeah.
It's time I had my say. My people have been silent for too long.
Have your say. This, I believe, is your track of the year, or at least part of it, because it's 8 minutes long. This is The Orioles and Sugar Tastes Like Salt. And Sugar Tastes Like Salt, track of the year from Eamon Ford. All right, who are they and why is this your track of the year, Eamon?
I only know very little about them because I think in this kind of day and age of kind of music ubiquity, you're hearing tracks and you're probably not investigating the artists in the way that you used to because you're spending your time listening to more artists. But they're all really young. I think they're kind of late teens or very early 20s. They're from Halifax. I think are some of them family members? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but they sound heavenly. And Heavenly seems to be having a bit of a kind of second wind at the minute. They're signing loads of really good people, loads of really fun stuff as well, like Confidence Man, who I saw twice this year. But I saw the Orioles at, it was in the basement of the Heavenly Social. And they were properly brilliant. I think that track was the only thing they'd put on. You're kind of going, like, that's a hell of a statement of intent, if that's what you're going for. This kind of weird 8-minute song that's basically about 7 songs at once, and lots of time signature changes, but without sounding indulgent and proggy. It's really clever, it's really smart, but it's like inherently loads of pop songs happening without kind of 7-8 time signatures.
It's basically one of your indie top 20 albums from 1987 put in a blender, isn't it?
It is. It's like, well, it's kind of
Pixies,
like,
you know, My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, the Jive Bunny of indie. Jive bunnied themselves.
The Boo Radleys.
But live, they're amazing as well. It's like they're really young and they've clearly put the hours in because they're really tight. They can play brilliantly. And they put out 2 other singles this year and they're great as well. But that one, just like to do this sprawling 8-minute song is all over the shop for your debut single, is quite a thing to come out with.
It slightly weirded me out the thought that, like, this is their record, this is their parents' record collection, things that I consider to be relatively recent, like My Bloody Valentine. That's what your mum and dad's record pile is.
Yeah.
All right, let's have your film of the year then, The Death of Stalin.
Yes. I haven't been to the cinema as much as I should have done this year, and then I was going to pick something else, which I watched on the popular DVD format after it came out.
How recherche of you.
Yes, I know.
Is it like the vinyls of films?
It is, yeah.
Do you get a real organic feel of the picture?
I'm all about Betamax these days now. Yeah. I've moved on. Death of Stalin was brilliant for lots of reasons. Well, first of all, it was just a great kind of concept. What is the fallout of the immediate aftermath of Stalin's death? And he kind of dies, spoiler, obviously he dies, but he dies kind of halfway through. And it's about, I guess, kind of that state of paranoia in Russia at the time, because obviously Stalin was basically his blood trials and basically killing tens of millions of people in Russia, and everybody's like super paranoid. So there was one bit where the guard standing outside his room hear him kind of slump down, and they're terrified to go in to check that he's all right in case he is all right and they've kind of done the wrong thing, that they've interrupted him or something like that. And then it's about the political jostling that kind of followed that as well. And I love the fact that every actor just did it in their own accent, because yeah. I read an interview with Armando Iannucci, who kind of, he co-wrote it with Ian Martin and Peter Bainham,
on a graphic novel, didn't it?
And he said, well, basically, in Russian politics at the time, you would have had people who were from all over Russia coming in, so there would have been loads of vastly different regional accents. We just had, like, why try and get them all to do the Hollywood perception of an evil Russian?
So you had Steve Buscemi, and then you had Michael
Palin and all these people. So you had, like, American accents and Northern English accents and stuff like that. And I just thought it was really good. And obviously the guy who played Stalin's son as well was just, like, it was proper scenery chewing when he appeared on stage, and it was just brilliant. I thought it was really smart and really clever and didn't overstay its welcome as well. It was relatively short.
Why do you think it is that, you know, the only comparable 20th century kind of political or historical thing like Hitler and the rise of the Nazis in Germany has been mined so deeply for kind of fiction and films and books and, you know, historical, loads of different historical perspectives, and yet Stalin, I'm trying to think, you know, there's this, people are going to come up with loads more now, there's the kind of Master and Margarita. I'm trying to think kind of maybe Gorky Park and that kind of stuff, but that was after.
Well, there was also, and I think we mentioned this on a podcast when we reviewed the film, there's also a fantastic Channel 4 movie, Red Monarch, which has David Suchet as Beria, and they do, on the accents front, they do everybody with an Irish accent. They just do the whole of the
racists.
No, because it's like, you know, why not? You know, it's kind of it's every bit as ridiculous to try and do a fake Russian accent as to do a fake Irish one. It is the same kind of black comedy thing.
Yeah,
it's really worth seeking out if you enjoyed Death of Stalin. Red Monarch is fantastic.
Do you think the German experience was that everything was open afterwards and there was a democracy and there was, whereas Russia still hasn't had that. Although they went through the kind of
Stalin was attacked for being anti-Russian, you know, this year. So this is Western propaganda to attack us. They're still quite, you know, there are very few people, although more than you thought, who'll defend Hitler now in the West. Very few. Whereas Stalin still has his defenders around the world. There are still Stalinist regimes in existence. There are still, you know, there's a great deal of nostalgia for Stalinism in the Soviet Union, because now that Russia is a kleptocracy, they say it as a time when at least there was food on the shelf. So I think that's one of the reasons. Also, let's face it, movies get made in the West and Hitler's a bit closer to home than Stalin.
Yeah.
You can still dig out an old tanky or go, ask Robert Wyatt. Stalin wasn't Stalin. You can still find Stalinists in the West.
Well, I suppose there's kind of higher drama related to the war as well. Because you've got lots of fight and stuff like that. Obviously, the Russians, there were tens of millions of people killed, but that was kind of people just disappeared.
It was all very mundane and
It was kind of like the routine of evil or whatever. So it wasn't like, obviously there were kind of flashpoint moments in his rule, but it wasn't like the Normandy landings or whatever. You don't have those kind of big set pieces. That sounds very crass to kind of put it in dramatic terms. But, and I think it's a lot of it was to do with politics and bureaucracy and stuff like that. And that's very hard to dramatise.
Yeah. Also, it's very hard to dress up as Stalin, but with Hitler, you just do a little bit of moustache, don't you?
Or
in my case, you stand in a high wind and your hair goes like Hitler anyway. We've given everybody four choices for this show. And Eamon, your other, open quotes, other close quotes of the year is this band of yours, Shame, that you seem to be completely obsessed by. He even bought a t-shirt like a big kid.
I have bought a t-shirt.
Why
I bought
do you
two
love
t-shirts.
Shame?
Because the
most shame.
I have no shame about Shame. I was thinking about this on the way in. I think they're probably my midlife crisis band, because I haven't had a midlife crisis. So I'm just going to set this aside and just go, they are my midlife crisis band.
I'd hesitate to say that your midlife crisis probably started about the age of 12 and is continuing.
Right, okay. Yeah, it's downhill
it's
from here.
It's just your default position.
Yeah. Well, I think by the end of the year, I'll have seen them six times this year, which is, that's kind of getting quite terrifying.
That's stalkery, that.
Yeah, it's kind of getting very stalkery. I saw them, like, sight unseen at a conference in Norway, and somebody who was, I know who is working at the label, they are now signed to, they hadn't been signed at this point, I basically said, go and see this band. I think you might like them. And it was just one of those things where it's like, it's a conference, there's loads of bands playing, and you kind of do dot around. And you see lots of bands, you kind of go, oh, it's quite good, I quite like them. And then they came on, and they were just the most terrifyingly exciting and fun thing I'd seen in ages. And then I had to go home afterwards because I can't go and watch another band after this because they're all going to look terrible. And then I kept, and then they played in London a couple of days later, and they played in Birthdays in Dalston, and like the kids were just like, they suddenly had this kind of groundswell of support. And then I've kind of seen them, they did Tufnell Park, and then I saw them at the Scala, and they're doing the Electric Ballroom in February, no, March, I think. Album's out next year. What, and they're just brilliant. They're just so full on and exciting. They're basically what you want from a kind of grubby band. What, and they can really play as well. And they've got songs.
Who do they sound like?
Who do they sound like? Kind of post-punk, basically. Basically, everything kind of after the Fall, I suppose. I think the kind of Fall would be, they don't sound like the Fall, but it's that kind of attitude. Mm. And
I thought you said they could play.
Yes, they can play. There's like elements of kind of Wire and Gang of Four and stuff like that. They kind of came up in the circuit in South London under the grubby wing of the Fat White Family, and they're kind of like the Fat White Family if the Fat White Family had bothered to write songs rather than just kind of create mistake around themselves and take drugs and live in a hovel. So they're basically the Fat White Family with ambition, which I think some people dislike them for that because they kind of go, oh, they just ruined everything that's great about the Fat White Family. I go, well, the Fat White Family had one song, so...
Well, I was going to sort of ask you about that because, I mean, for the defining aspect of bands lately is they sort of given up on being big because you can't anymore. You know, there's the idea of being like super ambitious. 10 years ago, you know, the defining aspect of a landfill indie band would have been they thought that they could be huge just by sounding like the Pigeon Detectives. It would just, you know, saunter straight onto the Reading Festival and onto the telly. And it's like, that just doesn't happen anymore. Is this a band that is making the uncommon and surprising move of let's try and be big?
Well, I don't think just the nature of what they're doing. I don't. They're not going to be playing the O2. Yeah. I don't think. But everybody I've spoken to and I've interviewed them a couple of times, they're really clued up. They're really smart. They've been playing together. They're all like kind of 19, 20, and they've been playing together since they were 16. And it shows they've kind of got like it's really tight. And they've just got an incredible work ethic as well. I think they said they were going to do something like 150, 160 gigs this year alone. They're just constantly on the road and touring kind of all over the place. And it's like the shows are really intense. You kind of go, my God, obviously they can't be doing that. It's a bit like kind of seeing, I don't know, the Stooges at the peak were kind of Iggy Pop's like shirtless in the crowd within the third song, and it's like you just go, right, okay, anything can happen at this show. But like obviously it's not like Queens of the Stone Age where they kick photographers in the head.
Yeah, and this sounds like the mathematical opposite of stylist music. Do you think you're going to be throwing shame into the
I think I'm probably fairly atypical amongst my colleagues in terms of what I'd listen to, though it's always me. If I try and get into the office first, then I'm the one putting either Radio 6 or Me Soul or something on, so I'm probably not a fair test case when it comes to stylist music. The idea of really exciting shirtless post-punk, I was thinking, oh, I've got to look them up when I get back. So.
Shirtless
they
post-punk.
Are very good. The album's out in the middle of January, okay. And it's wonderfully titled Songs of Prayers, and there's a picture of them all carrying little pigs on the front.
Oh, lovely. Finally, your album of the year, unsurprisingly, it's Hippopotamus by Sparks.
Yes. Now,
as you and I know, they are the greatest band ever.
Of course they are. The greatest of all the bands.
The greatest of all the bands, and we had them on the show. What makes this a really good Sparks album? More importantly, how can we get Sparks deniers like Matt, for instance, to accept that Sparks are fantastic?
Well, they are the greatest band. They are the greatest of all the bands. I don't know. I think any year that Sparks put out an album, and I know I'm biased, it's obviously going to be my favourite album of the year. And there's lots of people kind of going, oh, well, it's a kind of a late period return to form and stuff. But they've been on a hot streak since Little Beethoven in the early 2000s. So they've been putting out possibly the best music of their career, and they haven't kind of put a foot wrong since Little Beethoven. They suddenly had this kind of creative renaissance. They're just everything. They're kind of like, if you boil down what you want from pop music, you want great tunes, you want things that are smart and clever and funny and self-aware and erudite and not afraid to be intelligent and pull in huge reference points from kind of low culture and high culture into this kind of great kind of mixture of stuff. And Ron Mayall is probably the most underrated lyricist in the world. I think he doesn't get enough credit because their lyrics are phenomenal. And he writes about stuff that nobody else writes about, like his perspective on things. He'll take something really mundane and he'll look at it in a slightly different way. And nobody else, there's nobody else who writes lyrics like him. So they're always interesting. Mm. And I know it's like a spin in that whole John Peel line about the fall, always the same, or always different, always the same kind of thing. But Sparks are just consistently interesting. They're kind of what you want from a band because they've never kind of lost that sense of adventure. Because loads of bands get into a routine and they just, it becomes a trend. They've got a sound and Sparks seem to just want to rip it up Sparks every
always,
time.
The fall were always the same but always different, and Sparks are always different but always the same.
Yeah.
Anna, do you have a position on Sparks?
I do, actually. One of the things, I really love Sparks, but one of the things I like... Sorry, Matt.
3 out of 4, we win.
3-0.
One of the things I really like they've done, though, was actually a side project of theirs with a Belgian singer called Lilo. And she's like a French speaking Belgian singer from the 80s, and she did this English, her only English language album was produced by Sparks, and it has this incredibly sarcastic song on it called Housewife of the Year, which is kind of like a sort of almost like if your robot Hoover, if your Roomba could come to life and like sing this very kind of bitingly cynical song about being the perfect wife and homemaker. And that was a Sparks production, but the whole album is called Banana Split and it's very good.
I didn't even know about this. I'm going to download it. Matt, have we convinced you?
No.
Why not? What's your objections?
One word, mannered.
Oh, come on.
Nothing wrong with a bit of manners. They're not mannered.
When
it's built on a massive pinnacle of manners.
But isn't that Bowie? Isn't that Dylan? Isn't that all the best?
Artificial fake pop is the best pop.
Well, yeah.
I hate things that are for real. Things that are for real are boring. But they
write about real things, but just in... And it's not like in a Sunday broadsheet, a wry sideways glance at something. Yeah. They actually have genuinely unique perspective. Like
we mentioned, they might be giants earlier.
Yeah,
I'd put them
in the same.
Well, see, you want a song that is about a real thing that we can all relate to. Let's see if this converts.
Hippopotamus is in your swimming pool.
No, this is from the album Hippopotamus. This is Sparks and Missionary Position.
It's a surprise at my terrestrial frequency, but we both are smiling as you will. And it ain't no joke, it ain't the rope, it's the missionary position. It's a little retro and the people say, but you know you made the feeling of me, that you feel so right, the stars are bright, the missionary position.
Sparks with Missionary Position from Eamon Ford's album of the year, Hippopotamus. Now, Anna Fielding of Stardust Magazine, now it's your turn. Let's start with your TV show of the year, which is?
It's The Handmaid's Tale.
Okay, well, here's a taste, and we're going to talk about it in a second.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen. When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake. My name is Offred. I had another name.
Ladies, I have to let you go. It's the law now.
They needed to do it this way. All the bank accounts and the jobs all at the same time. You imagine the airports otherwise?
Run, run, run!
No, please, don't take her! No!
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
An eye in your house. We'll send you to the colonies. You'll be cleaning up toxic waste and then you'll die.
Tonight is a celebration of Gilead and of what we have achieved.
We only wanted to make the world better.
Better?
Better never means better for everyone.
I want to keep on living for her.
Remember your scripture. Blessed are the meek.
And blessed are those who suffer for the cause of righteousness.
The official trailer for The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood adaptation that went out on Channel 4 earlier this year, and it is TV Show of the Year as chosen by Anna Fielding of Stardust Magazine. Anna. Now, this is one of the most acclaimed shows, not just of this year, but of the decade so far. Why is it so fantastic?
I was actually initially quite nervous when I heard they're adapting The Handmaid's Tale. I really, really love the book. I love it to the extent that it actually survived being an A-level set text for me, which is normally something that grinds up literature and spits it out.
We just got the Mayor of Casterbridge. You got a really good one.
Exactly. And it survived even with reading the York notes. So I was quite nervous because it's also quite a hard book to adapt, I think, because so much of it is the narrator's own internal tale. I think they did incredibly well casting Elizabeth Moss.
She was fantastic phenomenal
so
in
good.
It.
And she's the kind of actress who can, and she did the same in Top of the Lake, but can convey a very complex range of emotions just by looking very straight at the camera full on. They've obviously deviated from the book quite a lot in terms of making it a pacier plot and things, but I think they stuck very clearly to the central theme. I think it ended up being weirdly appropriate for now as well.
Well, in the unlikely event that any of the listeners don't know what it's about, effectively you've got a kind of a fertility collapse produces a religious patriarchal theocracy in America, the Republic of Gilead. And we see it all through the eyes of Offred, the Elizabeth Moss character, where women have been... I love the fact that I'm mansplaining the Handmaid's Tale.
I can speak if you want.
The mansplain's tale.
Handman's tale.
The footman's tale.
Tell us what's happening in the Handmaid's Tale.
So because of this fertility crisis and because it's gone back to a very literal interpretation of parts of the Old Testament, fertile women who are either on their second marriage, which are counted as invalid or gay or single, are sort of scooped up and rounded up and made to become handmaids who are assigned to a commander, one of the senior officials of the regime, and their wives, and made to have sex with them once a month while they lie on the wife's lap in order to get pregnant. And they are completely defined, and their status in society is only due to their fertility. And other than that, they're kind of nothing. So it's the kind of weird kind of state institutionalized monthly rape, which is a very odd way of putting it. It's a terrifying, terrifying vision of how a society could work, but it does seem really quite horrifically plausible as well. Like the set of dominoes that go off, I think there was a scene at the very beginning where you can see the central character going into her job in an academic book publishers and all the women just suddenly being told that their bank accounts are frozen and they've all lost their jobs. And if you think how quickly it would be to enact something like that, if someone really wanted to, I think that's the point where you start getting very emotionally invested in it as well, because you're just like, actually... It could.
The flashbacks worked. They didn't kind of heavily lay them on, but I think they were there just to kind of as little reminders of this was literally a year ago and normal life was going on and then suddenly society's inverted. And I think it was quite true to the book in a lot of ways. Obviously, they had to kind of extend the dramatisation and they left the end a bit kind of open. And that kind of thing. And then there's that whole end bit of the book, which is basically in the future.
Yes.
They kind of found her notes and cassette recordings and stuff. And it's at like some kind of academic
symposium. It's an academic conference in Alaska.
And they're talking about this and they're kind of going, they're trying to verify did this actually happen or whatever.
The end of the book has this wonderful chapter that's set at an academic conference in Alaska, partly because the world has warmed up so much that they've gone that far north and the big serious universities are all up there now. So they're looking at it as a period of study, as a historical conference about 100 years into the future, and they found this box of tapes, cassette tapes, from her being smuggled out on the Underground Female Road. They're trying to work out if they're valid, if they were propaganda that was planned. And so it just ends on this very strange note of this person that you've known so intimately.
But what I really liked about that was the idea that, because the book's actually quite a short book, isn't it? It's a little slice. And the big difference between the book and the TV dramatisation is, on TV, she's a heroine and things are going to happen and stuff's going to change. And in the book, she's a nobody. It's the record of a life that nobody really, another one of the countless hundreds of thousands of handmaids who are in the same position. But that little coda, the bit at the end, they're looking in a very detached and dispassionate and almost amused way at this horror story you've just experienced. And it just puts you in that position of re-examining your own ideas about history. Yeah. You know, the things that we think, oh, you know, hilarious things that happened in the past. Oh, the witch trials, that was funny, wasn't it? No, you're living through it. It is the worst thing that has ever happened to date, and it's happening to you.
It was kind of really clever, sorry to interrupt, it was like kind of really clever motif, kind of going, this is the very near future that this is happening in, and then this is how that being viewed 100 years down the line. So it's about that kind of sense of perspective and chronology and how that can be warped.
Yeah.
I think it's also quite interesting because I think I can see why they did it for the TV show as well. But as you were saying, she's more of a heroine. Not only did you need more action, but in the book, you get a very constrained slice of a life in Gilead because you only ever see it through Offred's... I always find it interesting she's called Offred as well, because that's the name of her commander, Fred, but she's also Offred, which is the colour of their uniform.
And apparently, and because it was supposed to, it's a near kind of anagram of Offred as well.
But you only ever see it from a very constrained perspective in the book, whereas you get a kind of more omniscient view of other events going on and other characters' storylines in the TV series. So actually the world expands a bit more as well. Yeah. It's almost, like... being able to get up and walk around a bit more if you know the world of the book really well.
And the kind of religious, you know, the religious government is a really interesting. You hesitate to say that everything can be filtered through kind of Trump, but you can see how that kind of the religious right in America, it's not too many steps away from it all of a sudden, everything clicks.
Yeah, well, it's basically kind of about opportunistic politicians who kind of take a mood or take a moment and flip it, and then suddenly you're kind of on the other side, and it's like really dark.
Yeah, Anna, do you think that this, as Matt just said, is arriving in the middle of Trump and the rise of the extreme traditional conservatism, but it also kind of it arrived like 5 minutes before Weinstein and everything all spilled out. This is, you know, The Handmaid's Tale has not inaugurated a brand new wave of feminism at all. It's been, if anything, sort of pushed to the fore by that. But do you think this is a moment when something in entertainment has changed stuff in the outside world? You would see women turning up at demonstrations in handmade outfits just to make the point, with cosplaying, political cosplay, you know?
I think it really has. I think it's provided something for people to latch onto. It's so, the book and the TV series had such a strong visual identity. I mean, part of the thing of kind of dehumanising women for the regime in Gilead is to make them all dress in identical uniforms, so according to status, so red for handmaid, blue for wives, green for Marthas, who are the domestic servants. So I think it's quite easy to take that really strong kind of visual symbolism and use it to kind of as a shorthand for bringing all of those ideas that we've all seen in The Handmaid's Tale now and push them in front of other people.
The criticisms of the show were sort of few and far between. I read one really, it made me quite angry, actually. I think it was in LA Weekly, which was basically saying, this is white people complaining about their lives. This is white people moaning about their lack of privilege. I thought it was an insanely reductive, knee-jerk way of looking at it. But it has to be said that the book kind of alludes to issues of race with in a very, very neatly by sort of alluding to the fact that the sons of Ham have been made to live elsewhere, i.e. black Americans have been exiled. There are more black characters in the TV version than there are in the book version, and they are primarily the Marthas and the female servants. Do you think that's going to explore that? I mean, because the series, season one is very much about the misogyny of this world. Do you think it can explore other aspects of that religious theocracy?
It's interesting because, you're right, and in the book they do have... They've done away with most of America's black Americans, and also were allowing Jewish people to be repatriated to Israel and then sank the boats halfway across the sea is one other horrifying detail you get in the novel. I think because they made quite a few, not just the domestic servants, but they made quite a few of the other characters. They changed their colour. So Offred's husband, Luke, and her best friend from university, Moira. I think it's a difficult one because you're looking at this very kind of odd conservative Christian thing, which generally, I don't want to talk ill of people, as I don't want to be like part of the problem and stereotyping myself, but generally that does lead to a rather blinkered view on race, if not outright racism. I did read an interview with the show creators that said they wanted to say, they thought, well, actually, if you looked at Gilead and the fertility was that much of a problem, then for a character like Moira, her fertility would absolutely get, it would be the kind of higher stakes thing than
it
her colour.
It would trump.
It would trump. I was actually, could you see me trying to avoid that word? Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of nominally a science fiction thing in the very sort of pure science fiction sense that the world has been altered. Not that it's filled with monsters, robots, spaceships, time travel, and all my favourite things. But this is pretty much the only open quotes science fiction, close quotes things that I can watch with my wife, who will not have anything to do with all my stupid shit that I like to watch on Netflix. But she found it absolutely captivating. And I just sort of think this is what good speculative fiction does. It gives the world a small but massively important tweet.
Well, like, it reminded me, and it was a book that you introduced me to, Man in the High Castle as well. It's that, like, that slightly what if, and it's one tiny thing, what if the Nazis won the war, and then this is the world that we would live
that's
in.
That's not a tiny thing.
Yeah.
How would it affect everything else?
I would also say Gary Steingart's Super Sad True Love Story is another one, which, given that he wrote it in 2007, it was published in 2008, so pre-crash, it's this wonderful kind of document. It's actually incredibly depressing, but very funny at
everybody
the same time.
It, yes.
No, it's incredibly good, and as a piece of speculative fiction about kind of runaway inflation in America and... again, a very authoritarian state taking over, and everything from kind of fashion trends to media policies. It's so good, and it's exactly the same kind of thing.
I'm just going to hammer this terrible joke.
Okay. While we're on books, then let's move on to your book of the year, which is Reservoir 13 by John McGregor.
Oh, I love
this.
What
is this all about?
This is the book I've been recommending to everybody, like a stuck record. It is absolutely fantastic. It came out in the spring. John McGregor is a British novelist. He's from Nottingham, I think. He published...
Big shout out to the Nottingham Massive.
Yeah, for Matt. He published his first book, I think, in the late 90s, which was called If Nobody Speaks of Remarkable Things. And as a writer, he has this incredible sense of rhythm with language, and it's very poetic. But Reservoir 13 has this kind of almost faux dramatic start. It's set in a town in what I think is probably the Peak District, because there's well dressing going on and things like that. But... and a girl who's on holiday there over a New Year period in a holiday cottage with her parents, she goes missing up the mountain, and it starts with this thing. But actually it's quite deceptive, because it's not about the missing girl, it's about the village life that surrounds it. And it's written in this way, it's actually quite experimental in how it's written, but in a way that really, really serves it and doesn't feel forced. And you don't sit here thinking, I'm reading an incredibly modernist work of experimental fiction. It just pulls you along with it. It goes sort of year by year. And it's everything from how particular crops are going, what they're doing with the sheep, to kind of, you know, the affair that one of the farmers is having with the school teacher. And, you know, it can be quite funny, and there are moments of drama, but everything is kind of subsumed into this rhythm. It is so well written and so clever.
It sounds like David Foster Wallace writing The Archers. Is that a fair description?
No, I don't think it is, actually.
Okay. Well done, Andrew.
It completely lacks Foster Wallace's cynicism, I think. It doesn't have that kind of misanthropic bite to it. It's actually a very generous-spirited book as well. So I think, although I think David Foster Wallace was a fantastic writer.
And he would have written a pretty good Archers.
He would have written an absolutely fantastic, I'd love to hear
lots
that
of
one.
Footnotes about shippens and middens and things like that. Are you still doing the books as a stylist, or have you moved as you've moved on upwards?
I'm not, no, unfortunately. I really miss that, although I'm not reading for review anymore, which is kind of weird, so I've been able to go sideways and backwards with things at the moment.
Yeah, because, I mean, one thing that, I mean, as you know, having cut your teeth in music journalism, one of the great things about music journalism is you can review while doing other things. Like reviewing books, you simply, you know, you can't review a book while doing the shopping or,
no,
you know, walking
you
around. It sort of just swamps you, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, luckily I read quite quickly. I can get through about two novels a week, but if I really put my mind to it. But it has been nice to be sort of freed from the kind of this much slower hype cycle that you get with literature, but still not quite the same as music, but still kind of my reading was planned out kind of month by month, depending on what was being published.
Let's have your album of the year then, which is Kalayla and Take Me Apart.
Yeah, Kalayla, I think she is fantastic. She makes a kind of spacey, futuristic sounding R&B that's also very warm and intimate at the same time. She's got an incredible voice. She's got a very kind of almost soothing voice. You can imagine her cooing in your ear. But at the same time, she's very sort of naked emotionally. But then if you hear her interviewed afterwards, she's also very political as well. And she thinks a lot about what it means to be a black woman in a certain space. And also a lot about the lineage of her music as well. And I think she's quite often, because she came up through sort of various independent labels, she's actually signed to Warp. So people tend to compare her to Aphex Twin, which is not an unfair comparison in terms of the production.
If you want the Ethiopian American female Aphex Twin, here she is.
Yeah, but I
who
think,
sings?
I yes. think also, yeah, who sings as well. But I think also that's not quite doing her justice, and it's not doing justice of the people that she's listening to, because she was thinking, she was saying, you know, Timbaland is an incredibly experimental producer. Some of Stevie Wonder's stuff is incredibly experimental. And just because she's on Warp doesn't mean that she automatically needs to be compared to this white dude, without any disrespect to Aphex Twin, who I also think is great. But so she has this brilliant idea, this brilliant thing of one, sounding like she's in your bedroom, and two, sounding like she's from 30 years into the future. And I couldn't ask for more than that.
Is that when Warp signed Maximo Power, people were wondering, what are they doing, kind of signing this kind of angular post-punk kind of art rock band, because it didn't kind of fit in what they do. So maybe is she kind of suffering a little bit from that, because she's not quite what you would expect from a Warp artist? Maybe there's a kind of shared aesthetic, but it doesn't kind of... There's a Warp sound in the same way that there is like a Ninja Tune sound. And then if you're slightly outside of that, you're going to be judged for that?
I think so, but I also don't think she's suffered. I think the critical reception's been great. But yeah, I know what you mean about the pigeonholing. She also started out... she's actually surprisingly old for a pop star. Please note that coda of for a pop star, isn't it? She's actually sort of put her first album out at the age of 34, which for a female pop star is nothing short of incredible. Yeah. Actually, it's like if you're 22 or you're toast, really, for a lot of people. But I think so. There's also a certain maturity to it, without it sort of getting into kind of terrible adult orientated pop kind of thing. She started out working with the Night Slugs crowd, who are a group of producers and DJs in South London and record label. Alex Bok is the one that people might have heard of as a DJ, but she did a mixtape with them as a vocalist. So although she's actually from Washington, she has this kind of tie in to sort of South London, sort of Dago grime culture as well. I think she's really cool. I like her a lot.
Let's have a listen. This is Kalele with, from the album Take Me Apart, this is LMK. That was Kalele with LMK from Anna Fielding's album of the year, Take Me Apart. Now, Matt Hall, it's your turn. A whole year on the faders and you finally get to make some choices. What is your album of the year, Matt Hall?
It has to be, I think, looking back over kind of what was bought and what was played a lot, it has to be Kendrick Lamar's Damn, which came out on Good Friday of 2017. And there may well be a reason for that, but we can discuss it later.
Well, here is, with his hot cross buns, it's Kendrick Lamar and the signature track from Damn. This is Humble.
My left stroke just went viral. Right stroke put a baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Bitch, be humble. Hold up, bitch. Sit down. Hold up, little. Be humble. Bitch. Hold up, bitch. Sit down.
Kendrick Lamar and Humble from the album Damn, from Matt Hall's album of the year. So Matt, why is it so great?
It's great because it was kind of like, I think it was probably the biggest hip-hop release of the year, because after To Pimp a Butterfly, everybody was saying, what's he going to do next? And he kind of answered his critics with a kind of return to slightly more simplified hip-hop, which was still after kind of Pimp a Butterfly, where he had Thundercat and George Clinton and lots of quite kind of trippy of that, you know, what friend of the pod Joe Mugford has described as kind of that trippy new West Coast sound. Mm-hmm. But he did it kind of musically straightforwardly. He had a U2 guest appearance, which obviously...
I love that.
More special for me, yeah. And apparently he's paid back the compliment by being on U2's latest album as well.
Nobody's perfect.
But he kind of reminded everyone what a good MC he is, and what a brilliant and conversational kind of flow he's got. But he also, what kind of what I really like about hip hop and what makes me kind of a bit of a rap nerd, I guess, is that I really like the way that you can. There's so many lyrics on your average hip hop track, and you can take ages to decipher it. And Kendrick Lamar kind of built that in. There was a lot of immediate, as soon as it came out, there was an awful lot of theories, kind of slightly tinfoil hat theories. The producer Soundwave, who worked on the album, kind of tweeted just before the album came out saying, "This isn't even the proper version." And everyone was immediately like, "What? What?" And then there was a whole thing on the day that it was released. The album cover has got him standing in front of a red brick wall with "Damn" on written in red. The day that it was released, he was then photographed. He changed his kind of avatar on Twitter and everything to him standing in front of a blue brick wall. Obviously, reds and blues, Crips and Bloods, LA gangs, but also there was another thing was released with him having with a logo of God written across that photograph, so that becomes God Damn. And then there was another one with Nation, so that becomes Damnation. And people were saying, hold on, actually, if you play this record backwards, I turn it around and play the last track first and play it in sequential order from the last to the first, it becomes a completely new album. The story of the album changes. Everyone was just like, this is a complete mad tinfoil thing. He's actually just released a collector's edition which does exactly that. So the idea being that you can actually listen to a record at the end of the first album, at the beginning of the first album, he gets shot and then dies and kind of goes back and looks at the life choices, how he came to that position. At the end, very end of the original album, DJ Kid Capri says, now we're going to spin it backwards. And the album ends with the same line that Kendrick says at the beginning. He says, so I was taking a walk the other day. It ends with that line as well. It's just a really, you know, there's a lot you can unpick.
It's basically the James Joyce's Ulysses of hip-hop.
It could well be.
Or that issue of Watchmen was a palindromic comic where the fact that...
That's a very good name. I'm going to start a band called Palindromic Comic.
Palindromic Comic, yeah. Anna, did you partake of the Kendrick Fest?
I did partake of the Kendrick Fest. What I really liked is that he has such a distinctive voice as well. Like, you can always tell it's Kendrick Lamar. And I know you can for, you know, but him particularly, you only need to hear a couple of bars and you're like, yes, that's him. In terms of his delivery and the way he phrases things, and I think that's something quite special.
And Humble was an absolute banger.
It was
like a monstrously really good single. Yeah. And you're actually very trendy, because I believe Pitchfork have named it their album of the year. You're down with the American Indie Kids.
Well, I'm going to out myself as very untrendy. I just couldn't get a handle on this. I gave it a good few goes, and I think I just have to admit that I am now in no way even remotely connected with hip-hop, because I just...
That's because you're a massive racist.
Could be because I'm a massive racist, yes. That's going to definitely go out on the Finnish podcast, isn't it?
let's rewind, and I will keep quiet.
It's interesting what you're saying about the massive, massive detail and clear thought that's gone into it. You know, I did wonder how many blunts one had to get through to get that particular revelation. But it's clearly there. It's not just, hey, man, if you play, Dark Side of the Moon over The Wizard of Oz, it's amazing. This is a real thing.
Yeah, and I think as Anna said, he is instantly recognisable, whether he's kind of guessing on a kind of pop track or, you know, his voice is being kind of multi-tracked, which he does quite often for the choruses. Eamon's right. Humble was huge. He dealt with his new status by... He was famously kind of slated by Geraldo Rivera on Fox News and lifted that clip and kind of puts it at the start of the record. So it's kind of, you know... I think it'd be really interesting to see what he does next, because the world is his kind of lobster.
Well, I'm going to give it another go. I'm going to play it all Christmas Day while my mum and dad are in the house and see how that one goes. Matt, in sharp contrast, your film of the year, I believe, is La La Land.
Yeah.
Jazz hands.
It was total jazz hands. It was just... It's kind of been forgotten now, almost. It's kind of, you know, that speed with which kind of film culture and all other kind of popular media kind of turns around. But it was really interesting to think back about what a stir it caused at the start of the year. The fact that it was a musical, the fact that it had Ryan Gosling in it, the fact that it was jazz. And all of those things kind of, I think, brought in a new audience to musicals. I'm not a particularly big musicals fan, but I thought it was just a really interesting film. And I thought it was a feel-good movie when you kind of start in the dark days of the first of the start of the year. I think you kind of needed that.
You know, everyone says it was a feel-good film, and I saw it when I had a day off.
about the end of a relationship and about how somebody's really moody.
I saw it when I had a day off, and admittedly, I wasn't in the best frame of mind anyway. But I thought, oh, I'll go and see La La Land. Everyone keeps saying it's a feel-good film. I cried so hard. It was luckily in the middle of the day on a Friday, so there were only about two other people in the cinema. But it was kind of like I was having to shove tissues in my mouth to stop making embarrassing cry sounds. I cried so hard that I got
Brando in The Godfather. Yeah.
I got salt from my tears in my ice cream tub, and I think it was just because
that's the next episode. It's the next flavour after salted caramel.
Oh,
salted liberal tears ice cream.
Literally. Yeah. And I think it was because it gave me this horrible sense of kind of life slipping by and it all being for nothing, and you have these wonderful Technicolor relationships and then they're gone, and you might have a successful career but then it's gone, and I found it incredibly depressing.
I really loved it. I mean, I
read some Philip Larkin to cheer yourself up.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I generally speaking hate musicals, and I find jazz very, very hard work, and for the first 20 minutes of this film I was absolutely ready to walk out because, you know, it's just so not me. And I ended up absolutely loving it. I thought it was really clever in unpicking what musicals are and what makes them, you know, the fantasy that they are. You know, with the returning to the theme of earlier in the show, it got criticism for, oh, well, this is, you know, white guy sorts out jazz and a white guy sorts out a woman's career for her. I thought that was a real misreading because the Ryan Gosling character is, he's a dick and he's a loser, isn't he? And she succeeds. It doesn't make her happy when she succeeds.
I mean, I think, you know, it was there's an awful lot of jazz they could have chosen for him to represent, and they rather cleverly, well, not cleverly, but obviously chose the most. You know, he wasn't playing in a kind of 12-piece Sun Ra tribute act, was he?
The Ryan Gosling orchestra.
Stronking away. Strangling geese in the background.
Yeah. But it would have been a very short film, wouldn't it? Ryan Gosling, come to my jazz club and see my jazz music. And she just goes, fuck this. And goes and hooks up with an interesting guy, you know. But no, it is great, actually. And the music I particularly liked, because to me, it was like Matthew Herbert house music. Played on a big band.
Really, really nice
and enjoyable. So, but where's it leading? Is there going to be more La La Land? Or is that a Black Swan, Jazz Hands Black Swan that we're going to see again?
I mean, I'd hope that there'd be more musicals. I'd hope that it does, you know. I mean, obviously, they're incredibly expensive for studios to put on. You know, you've got to kind of write the music. You've got to do it well. It's a big budget thing. But I'd hope that they look at the success and the importance of, and the way that the strike rate of that and think, yeah, we'll give it another go.
I'm holding out for Watchmen the musical.
That'd be amazing.
Just the Manhattan theme, Dr. Manhattan. Yeah. So give us your other, quotes, other choices is a TV show which is Designated Survivor.
Yeah, it's kind of gone under the red, kind of flew under the radar a little bit, although apparently it was the most streamed Netflix opening episodes when it first started. And basically what it is, it's a kind of West Wing for the post-apocalypse. And for those of you, after the Trump election, I started watching West Wing again, the box set, and kind of got about...
To imagine that this is the real... Yeah, precisely. The documentary of the real world isn't real.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it kind of didn't quite cut it. And so what happens in... And then Designated Survivor comes along, and what happens is... it's the State of the Union address, and there's this kind of weird thing, and a little kind of thing that happens in American politics, that because the whole of the government is in one place, both houses and the judiciary and the president are in one place for the State of the Union address in the Senate, they have a designated survivor. So they take one minor member of the government and put him in a safe space, safe house, away from, in case the worst happens, and the Designated Survivor starts with the worst happening, in that the Senate gets blown up, and so the vast majority of the American government is dead. And so this guy, Tom Kirkman, who was played by Kiefer Sutherland, who was a junior kind of housing secretary right the way down the ladder, and it transpires was about to get the elbow as well, all of a sudden finds himself as president, and how he deals with that, and how he pulls together a really fractured country, and how he, so there's lots of stuff set in the White House, lots of stuff about American kind of government, but at the same time there's this thriller situation where they're trying to track down the people who did this and capture them. And the second series has just started, is just about to finish, actually. And it's kind of, it's interesting how they've kind of progressed that thing along. But yeah.
Apocalyptic stories about American presidents aren't quite as much fun now as they used to be, are they? Because like 24, hey, that's great fun, you know, but it's sort of, it's a little bit, you know.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, but at the same time, you know, you either pick the scab of reality or you wallow in the cesspit of kind of fiction. I think I'm making the latter choice.
Yeah, give me the cesspit of fiction every time. I mean, one thing that has really stuck out this year is that we talk about all TV series, even things that were commissioned years ago, and all movies, even things that have been development for years. In the age of Trump, in the context of Trump, is everything's got to be seen through the context of Donald Trump. But very few people are making actual drama or comedy, I suppose, with the exception of Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live, that's about Trump.
Yeah.
There isn't, there's precious little stuff actually about him.
Well, I think it's quite interesting how such a kind of lens as the one you've just described does refract everything that you watch or read or listen to. It's kind of weird. You can't, you know, like Eamon was saying about Offred being offered. You know, it's that kind of interesting thing about when somebody creates a piece of art, are there what's intended and what's not, and actually is it what people pick up from it in when viewed at a later date, is kind of just as important and just as valid as the stuff that the artist or the kind of producers were intending.
Maybe it's going to take a while for kind of like proper art to reflect this, because obviously it's kind of. Like Last Week Tonight would have basically just not happened this year if it wasn't for Trump. That was like 95% of what they were talking about. So it's like satirical shows have obviously done really well. So then I think a year in, once you actually start to write drama scripts and stuff like that, then next year we'll probably see a whole wave of stuff that is genuinely Trumpian in that sense.
And I think also as well, it's so hard to keep up. The news cycle is so fast and so ridiculous that it works for sort of satire where you can rewrite up until you broadcast almost, but to do something longer term, I mean, look at Anthony Scaramucci. He managed to do 10 days which included,
and became a legend.
It included the birth of his first child and his divorce.
The thing that really sticks out to me though is that a given in the movies, and the more mainstream the movie, the more given it is that the American president is ultimately a trustworthy person who should be backed and defended. Every spy movie, every action movie, domestic comedies, it's like the president in the United States occupies the role that the Queen does here. Sort of, you know, not just the head of state, but this kind of repository of it's all going to be all right. How can you make an action movie, say, in 2019 when the president is clearly a threat to the United States, is clearly a danger? It's going to change things, isn't it?
It hugely is. I mean, the only other thing I can think of is also based on reality, which would be all the president's men. But that's and maybe some of the X-Files, which took from a very similar borrowing. But you can't. Yeah, you're right. There's the idea of trust and things, and that kind of contract has been completely and utterly smashed to smithereens. Yeah. There's no social contract there anymore, which is terrifying.
I'm just hoping at the end of all this, we're going to get a book called All the President's Morons. Matt, your single of the year.
Kind of just because it was the one thing that practically every generation of my family really got into was Stormzy, Big For Your Boots. It kind of showed how grime came across the blah, 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 blah mainstream. But it's just a really brilliant tune with a really fantastic chorus that both 7-year-olds and 75-year-olds can kind of chat along.
I like the way
he
pronounces the word boots as well. Butes.
Butes. Okay, well, get your boots on. This is Stormzy with Big For Your Boots.
We'll do that there.
Hello.
Right, let's go.
Stormzy with Big For Your Boots, as chosen by Matt Hall as his track of the year. And that brings us to the end of Big Mouth of 2017. Thank you to our guest, Anna Fielding. What do you want for Christmas?
I want a fake fur coat.
A fake fur coat?
Yeah, okay. I want to trot about and be glamorous.
Fair dues. Eamon Ford, thank you for coming in. What do you want for Christmas?
I just want to sleep for a couple of days.
You're going to hibernate.
I think it's kind of, this year's been really busy, and I'm kind of looking forward to just sitting and doing nothing for 5 or 6 days, just sit and read books. Watch a bit of tally, drink tea.
Is there any Mrs. Brown's Boys on?
There might be. I'll not be watching it.
And, of course, thank you to Matt Hall, without whom this show would just be me buttonholing people in the street and telling them about comics. Matt, do you want for Christmas?
You do that anyway, don't you?
I do, yeah. What do you want for Christmas, Matt? A cure for that amazingly,
for this, yeah.
Amazingly sexy voice you've heard. You were listening to Zap Brannigan, the producer of Big Mouth there. Remember, you can hear this episode and all of our back catalogue over the festive period at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts on that lovely new iPhone X Plus 1000 that you get from Father Christmas. And if you could run away from the family because they're driving you mad and leave us a review and a rating on Christmas Day, then that would be really, really nice. We're going to be back in the first week of January. In the meantime, have a fantastic Christmas and a happy new year. God bless us, everyone.
Tiny Tim.